the question does come up quite frequently as to exactly why the Marine Institute of Marine Science is in Fairbanks. And most frequently it comes up, I guess, when I'm on an airplane and I introduce myself to the person sitting next to me and establish that I'm with the Institute of Marine Science and it's in Fairbanks, and he'll say, "Oh, Fairbanks, that's the town down near the ocean, isn't it?" And I say, "No," and I have to go through the explanation as to why. A quick response would be, it's always been here, but I don't think that's very satisfactory. What I'd like to do today is create a scenario that we don't have an Institute of Marine Science in Alaska. We're going to create one, and we don't have, suppose we don't have one at the present time. That would affect where you put it, if you establish a new one, if you already had one. So suppose that we're going to create an Institute of Marine Science, and we're going to have the functions of that institute be both teaching and research. And where would you establish that? And we're going to exclude politics at the moment. Okay. The immediate answer would be you'd put it in a coastal community. Okay. So you look around at the other states, not that we have to imitate what other states are doing, but you can learn from what's happened there. What's happened in other states is that they put laboratories on the coast. You can take Friday Harbor at the University of Washington, or it's not at the University of Washington, it's in the San Juan Islands. Friday Harbor, Hopkins Marine Station, associated with Stanford, Ritter Labs in San Diego, Galveston Marine Center, and Newport Marine Center in Oregon. They're all on the coast. They've been there some period of time. No Institute of Marine Science has grown with them. They've remained marine laboratories, simply small facilities on the coast, with the exception of Ritter Labs, which eventually evolved into Scripps Institution of Oceanography. So what I'm saying is that clearly there is something necessary other than to be in sight of the ocean to establish a marine science institute. And I claim that the thing that's important is a university and a major university. So that determines where you do the teaching and research. So a university is far more important than salt water. If a primary need for the university is a primary need for the university is to teach students. And marine science is broken into four disciplines. The various disciplines are chemistry, biology, physics, and geology. And we require that our students have a degree, an undergraduate degree, in one of these disciplines or related disciplines. They come to the university and enter our graduate program. Oceanography or marine science is primarily a graduate program. It's strictly a graduate program at the University of Alaska. After they arrive at the university, they must take other courses other than oceanography courses, because it's an interdisciplinary science. So they must have access to the faculty of other disciplines, and they must have access to a major library. These require, of course, a major university. Now, these facilities also must be of the highest caliber possible. And the reason for that is that the program here at the University of Alaska competes nationally and internationally for students. And we are in the same competition as Scripps in California, Woods Hole in Massachusetts, and the University of Washington, to name a few. Because the pool of talented students wanting to get into oceanography is limited, all the major institutions are competing for the same students. In the past, we've been competing quite well. We have 40 students in the program. To get these students, we must convince them that they should come to Fairbanks and study oceanography rather than go to San Diego or Woods Hole or Honolulu. So we have to have something other than possibly the environment, and that's the major university. While they're here, their studies last from 2 to 8 years, and they've been highly successful in obtaining positions once they graduate. Our former students are found in nearly all the major oceanographic institutions in the United States. The students are found also within the Alaska state government, all the way from the Fish and Game up to or down to the governor's office, wherever you place the governor's office. We also have a number of students working in private industry, primarily within the consulting firms in Anchorage. Though many of our students remain within the state, others can be found throughout the nation and the world. Back to the requirement of the university, another important product that we have at the Institute of Marine Science is the knowledge gained through the research. And maybe I've gotten you convinced that students need the university, but why do you need the university to conduct research? We cannot, of course, bring the ocean to Fairbanks, so we have to go to the ocean in some manner. However, one of the best examples I can think of is a project I've been working on where I spent 30 days at sea last summer. I will have 2 years to analyze the data. So you don't need to spend all your time at sea. Now, hopefully, I will analyze those data faster than some other cruises. For example, the Challenger expedition. The data from the Challenger expedition is still not completely analyzed. That particular expedition was completed in 1872, so had a little over 100 years. So. With the advent of computers, however, we can analyze our data much faster. Of course, on the other hand, we also collect data much faster. So I'm not sure that the scientist is that much ahead, except that as far as time goes, it takes time to analyze the data with computers and without, of course. Another example that comes to mind as to why, or an example of not using the ocean even though you're there was that as a graduate student, I spent several summers at Woods Hole. I never went down to the ocean and gathered a sample. I was analyzing data that were gathered several hundred miles out at sea. So you don't need to go down with your bucket daily and grab a sample. Now, on the other hand, some marine scientists, particularly biologists, need a saltwater laboratory for their work. And in Alaska, we've established a marine center in Seward that has a saltwater laboratory. We are also attempting to build a modest public education facility similar to the one that they have at Newport, Oregon. This facility will house displays and an aquarium. In addition, Seward is also the home port of our research vessel, the Alpha Helix. So we treat Seward as sort of our avenue to the sea. Thus, I think you might be able to see that both research and teaching in marine science can successfully be carried out away from the sea in a university setting. I believe that the Institute of Marine Science will leave Fairbanks when the University of Alaska-Dutch Harbor is a major university with library, faculty, and other facilities. Even today, the establishment of the Institute of Marine Science should logically be in Fairbanks. Now, with my foot in the door here, I'd like to devote the last part of the talk to talking about some of the research that we're doing, that I'm in particular doing at the Institute of Marine Science. First of all, I'd like to get things in perspective as far as basic versus applied research. Most of the work that we all are doing at the Institute of Marine Science is what one generally might term basic research. I like to use the analogy of building a house. We're the people who go in and build the foundation and put up the walls. this is opposed to what I call the finishers, who come in and do the painting. And I contend that the painters are the applied researchers. So what I hope that we have been doing in the approximately 21 years that the Institute has been established in Alaska is that we've been building a very strong foundation of marine science. And eventually we'll get the painters in, and you'll see a lot more applications of the work we've been doing. To establish my particular field, I am a physical oceanographer, and I'm interested in water motion and the causes for that motion. Now, oftentimes, someone will ask me about fishing or whales or other marine mammals. I contend that's a lot like asking a meteorologist about hunting birds or farming, something like that. I have very little to do with things that live in the ocean. I'm primarily concerned with the water motion. And over the past 12 years, I've primarily been working in the Gulf of Alaska. I'll move over and we'll show a few slides here. The platforms that we've been using, start the first slide there. This is the research vessel Acona that the Institute acquired, I believe, in about 1966. And it was an 85-foot vessel. The Acona is the one on the left there. On the right. We had that until 2 years ago. The university research vessel fleet is owned almost entirely by the National Science Foundation, and they give the ships out on a long-term charter. And the Acona was the smallest vessel in the UNOS fleet, and we work in some of the roughest waters in the world. And finally, we convinced them that we needed something else, so they gave us the research vessel Alpha Helix. Next slide. The Alpha Helix is 133 feet long and much more suitable for the type of work we're doing. We can go out for 30 days at a time, and it's ice strengthened, so we can work up into the Bering Sea and up into the Chukchi also. But it's owned by the National Science Foundation. They give most of the money to operate this. The state of Alaska this year has given us equivalent of 10 days of ship time. The ship generally operates for 180 to 220 days per year. And as I said before, it's based in Seward. Now, we've been looking at the coastline of Alaska and the circulation near shore, and one of the characteristics that the Alaska's coasts have that other coasts don't are the vast mountain ranges right next to the beach. We don't have the sandy beaches, of course, that Hawaii does, but we have mountains projecting up out of the water. For a number of years, there was no purpose in me showing a slide like this at a scientific meeting, but now I'm glad to say that I've come up with a purpose. If I can have the next slide. This is the northern Gulf of Alaska, very similar to that previous one that was down near southeast. In the background, you can see the snow-capped mountain ranges and a glacier moving down. What happens is that the mountains keep the moist marine air from penetrating very far inland. That makes, of course, Fairbanks dry and the coast very wet. What happens to that water is that it remains either on the coast in the form of, next slide, in the form of glaciers like this down by Alec, or it runs off back into the ocean. and you can look at the, I have a map of precipitation. You can't make it out in any detail, but down near the coast, there are high rates of precipitation. That water runs then into the ocean, and we have a coastal current that moves around, going northward from British Columbia and Southeast Alaska, and it traverses around the Gulf of Alaska. And this fresh water then enters the Gulf of Alaska, and we finally come to the conclusion that it drives the coastal current. Like now, the next slide. The next one is a satellite photograph, and with the points that I want to make are similar to the one I just did. That the coastal current flows in an anti-clockwise manner around the shores or the coastline of the Gulf of Alaska. This is the northern Gulf of Alaska. The Prince William Sound is right up in the corner there. You can get the perspective there. But this is an infrared satellite photo. We depend a lot on describing general circulation features for the infrared. The next figure gives you a schematic of what the coastal current looks like. It's equivalent about 1.5 times or 1.2 times the discharge of the Mississippi River as it gets over near Seward. So we can, in vague terms, lay claim to the largest river in the U.S. It's the fifth largest river in the world, if you want to classify it as that. I'm a bit hesitant to do that since we've gone through it a number of before we ever realized it existed. But it is important to the marine mammals and the fish in the coastal areas. The precipitation there in that coastal band has reached up to 28 feet in 1 year. So that when people complain that it rains a lot down in the coastal areas, they aren't fooling you. But most of the high rates of precipitation take place up in the mountains. So this is one of the major things that we found in the past few years, and I think that the other disciplines, the biologists and the geologists, will be looking at this. We hope to get money from the National Science Foundation to go out and put some current meters and do other measurements in this. Now, another project that I've been working on, in the next slide I'll show the general circulation of the North Pacific. This is the work that I was doing on the Alpha Helix last summer. We were trying to establish what the circulation of the North Pacific actually looked like. The subarctic current, see if I got enough line here, it's gonna,
yeah.
That's better. The current flowing from west to east in the North Pacific enters or encounters the North American coast at about the latitude of Seattle. There it has a choice of either going into the Alaska current or into the California current. Therefore, the two currents are closely linked and the water is either one or the other. It then turns northward and flows around the Gulf of Alaska. This is not to be confused with the coastal current. This is about 100 miles offshore. And then it turns west in the northern part of the Gulf of Alaska and flows back toward the Asian coast. And the question that we were trying to answer with our crews last summer was, does that water go all the way to the Asian coast and then turn around in one large circle, or does it turn around in mid-ocean, like this particular figure depicts? We're not saying that this is right, and we were trying to determine where that water turns around. So we had a cruise out there, and we discovered that the gyre, the Alaskan gyre, was as far west as anyone had ever seen it. I'm not making any predictions that that had anything to do with the weather, but it could. One of the tools that we used on that particular cruise, if I can have the next slide, was a piece of hardware that was a drifting buoy. And these are about 10 feet long and contain a radio and a battery. And they transmit each minute a brief signal that's picked up by Argos, a French satellite system. The antenna is up in the upper part here, and they're attached to a drogue that's about 100 feet below the surface. So they float around. Next slide. They float around and look like that out there in the ocean. Well, about every 6 hours, a satellite passes over. They pick up the signal that the buoy is transmitting, and that, by a very convoluted route, gets back to us. Now, that convoluted route, it gets out here at Gilmore, it's received there, it's then transmitted back over to Suitland, Maryland, then they retransmit it to Toulouse, France. People in France tell us where the satellite, or where the buoy is. They transmit that position back to Suitland, Maryland, and because we can't access, we have some problem with the phone lines, we can't access their computer, some people in British Columbia do that for us, and they put it on another computer that stores it in Virginia, and we finally get the position. It's very nice in that I can just sit in my office and type into the computer and get the position. I don't have to worry about the path it's taken. So this is a nice way to study oceanography. You don't have to be out there in the boat the whole time. And batteries, we hope, will last about a year. Now the tracks of these buoys in the next figure. And if you can orient yourself, the Kodiak is here, and the buoys we put out along a line along 160, right down through here. And the two southern buoys are going eastward, similar to that schematic that I showed. They're both going east, and the big question is, which way are they going to go? Are they going to go in the California current, or are they going to go in the Alaska current? We hope the batteries will last. The next furthest one north is started in the Alaska current that's flowing westward, but it turned around and is coming back. The one that we purposely put in the Alaska current flowed quite a bit westward and then turned around. So these, it looks like the gyre, there is some evidence that it's closed there. Now, one of the more interesting ones is the one that we let go just to the north of the Alaska current, and that one almost went through UMAC Pass into near Dutch Harbor into the Bering Sea, but it did continue down along the coast and went into the Bering Sea and then came back out again. If you notice, the track stops at that point. At that point, it began going north at about 8 knots. We discovered that we determined that something was wrong at that point. It went up into the Bering Sea, and then it immediately went westward at about 8 knots. And in the next slide, you'll see its ultimate fate. If you can read the caption on the bottom of the truck, it's Wakanai. It ended up in Hokkaido, on the island of Hokkaido in Japan. It had been picked up by a Japanese fishing vessel. We tracked them across the North Pacific, knew exactly when they got into port, and we knew exactly the path they'd taken. I guess they were somewhat amazed. We have contacts in that particular port, and within a couple of hours after the ship got in, we had someone down there locating the buoy. They were very cooperative, and if you backtrack that one slide, you can see that the trace picked up again here. And they brought the buoy back and put it back in for us. I hope that they're convinced that they're helping science by doing that. We convinced them that it was of scientific value, and it might be of interest to them as far as the fisheries go. And so we got our buoy back, and it's working just fine. These will continue, as I said, to transmit for another 6 months or so, and we're very curious as to the ultimate fate of these. We don't expect to ever pick any of them up again. Oh, by the way, they did write in Japanese, "Do not disturb." We only had "Do not disturb" in English until that point. Maybe we should have done it in Russian also. The next, in it's a little dark, but that's one of the stormier days at sea, and that was the roughest day we had last summer, and then I'll close with a sunset there. In closing, what I would like to say is that I hope that Alaska will see more benefits from the Institute of Marine Science in the next decade. I think that it takes about 10 years for basic research to have many applications, and I hope that you'll see that in the next 10 years. Other than the, I'm not sure that Fairbanks will see any direct benefits other than the approximately $8 to $10 million that we spend in the local community, but at least the state of Alaska will see some benefit and ultimately that feedback to Fairbanks. I thank you for the opportunity. Glad to answer questions.
How deep is the current? How deep is the water going? Mile deep?
That's a very good question, and we haven't gotten down to look at the bottom layers. Those buoys are at the surface. We need to put current meters at the bottom. But it goes all the way to the bottom there. But it oftentimes reverses itself before you get to the bottom. Now, some people from Woods Hole were working in cooperation with an expedition that was out there last summer, and they've got some current meters down in the bottom in that same area, and we're going to compare our results. But it's not true that the deeper you go, the stiller the water becomes. It's sometimes you can get some pretty hefty currents at near bottom. This was one of the suppositions that they always had when they were going to dispose radioactive waste at the bottom of the ocean, that they would just sit there, but that's not necessarily the case.
Dr. Royer, yeah. Does the Institute now have a limnology section of freshwater lakes and rivers?
The Institute of Water Resources, I think, would contend that we don't. We do have at least two people, including our director, who are interested in freshwater lakes. We don't limit ourselves to saltwater. Questions? Marvin.
You used the term Woods Hole several times today and said there was an oceanographic institute there. And it's my understanding that there is a Woods Hole on my campus at the university. So I'm not familiar with the institute.
It's not on salt water.
Maybe Dr. Woods would tell us.
That's a fountain area. It's not salt water.
Not so long. You've got it from the authority.
Thank you very much, Dr. Royer. I can assure you we are pleased to have that $8 or $10 million spent in the Fairbanks area. Yes. Our program next week has not yet been determined. Our program chairman, Marvin Andreessen, has promised an outstanding program as he has had in the past, even if he has to talk himself to the audience, that is. If there's no further announcement, we adjourn.
Well, I'm so glad you came and joined us.
Center. Is it Women's Center, Women's Resource Center?
Women's Center. Okay, let me give you just a little bit of history about how the Women's Center came to be. Last year when I first came on campus, there was a group that had sort of been limping along the prior year, but got activated again. It was called the Women's Network. And it was faculty, staff, and student women who got together about once a month. And the intent had originally been that the Women's Network would function as a more traditional network for job orientation, career laddering, career connecting. But it became obvious almost from the very beginning that what was really needed by the women on this campus was simply a forum to meet with one another and talk about shared concerns and common experiences of being a woman, particularly for the younger female students. So the network really took on the shape of more of a basic sort of consciousness-raising kind of group, and pointed out to me and to others that what was lacking on this campus was in fact a resource, a center or service available to women where they felt they could go to get access to resources to meet their needs.
This isn't a counseling center.
No. Well, some quasi-counseling. That's probably a bad term. Well, let me finish just a moment on sort of on the evolution of it. So as we began discussing in the network where they wanted to go and what they wanted to do, they being the women on campus, and what they felt were the biggest needs, it became more and more clear that what they needed was, number one, a place to talk with one another, number two, a place to access information about existing resources that were already available on campus, i.e. career counseling, health counseling, and personal counseling, services that we have functional but somehow weren't reaching women as a targeted group. So the idea of the Women's Center evolved from those needs, and we talked about the formation of it over the course of the year with a core group of women on campus of probably 20 to 30 women, primarily students at that point. I approached Chancellor O'Rourke and Harris Shelton, and they were both most supportive of the notion and had also felt that in their dealings with women students that there was something missing in terms of the institution's ability to make its resources available to women and to tailor some of its resources to the specific needs of women. So when I suggested the formation of a women's center, they were enthusiastic about that and provided the necessary initial funding to put somebody on full-time in a clerical position to staff a center. What the intent is in the early stages is to provide a place, a physical space, where we will have access to a variety of resources for specifically aimed for women. By resources, I mean information about career counseling, health counseling, pregnancy, sexuality, legal, educational, political concerns as they affect women. And by resources, I mean a variety of publications, brochures, access to groups within the community that are already doing work in these areas, access to groups on campus that are functioning in these areas. We're linking closely with the Career Counseling Office, with the Health and Counseling Office, particularly Health and Counseling.
You're located very close to
right.
Here.
We had a great deal of difficulty trying to secure space on campus, as has everyone on campus that needs space these days. And after a variety of setbacks and stone walls, we are now preparing to move into space in the Health and Counseling Center, which I think will be of great benefit to both the Women's Center and to Health and Counseling. One of the problems that the people in health and in counseling have had is that they've become somewhat stigmatized with being a place where people go when they are sick. It's become institutionalized and formalized, and they're not able to take their resources out into the community in preventative kinds of ways like they would like to. And so we felt that having the Women's Center there and...
Yeah. I did mention, I think also, that I thought this university needed to better serve the Alaska Native population of the state.
And also one of the difficulties that the people in the counseling office have had is that they've been dealing with almost totally crisis counseling. They're understaffed. They've had to turn away a lot of students, primarily women students, who don't really need crisis counseling but need to have other people to talk to about concerns of being a student, of being away from home, of having difficult personal relationships, problems in academic studies, counseling situations that don't require the need of a professional counselor but require the need of a support group. So they're looking forward to our being able to provide for them that kind, for those students, that kind of a supportive environment. We're looking forward to being able to have access to the professional expertise of counselors, several of whom have had a great deal of experience in counseling women. So that will be a very much a positive relationship for both of us.
Are you reaching primarily students? What about staff on the campus who are going through problems, females who want to make career moves but aren't sure how to go about it? Will that continue to be a function of the network, or will they too have the opportunity to access the center?
Yes, the center really will serve four constituencies as I see it: faculty, staff, students, and wives of faculty, staff, and students. And we've had a great deal of discussion with members of each one of those different constituencies. There are probably 75% of the issues impacting women impact women regardless of where they are in the hierarchy of life or where they are age-wise. Then there are the other 25% of the issues are issues that are of concern to specific groups. And we've identified some of those problems and some of those issues by group and certainly hope that we're going to be able to address concerns for each group. For instance, among the student group, the biggest concerns and issues are sort of basic self-awareness, self-identity, career counseling, sexuality. I'm just giving out my number. I said sexuality, health issues.
Just about everything.
Yeah, you know, real basic kind of self-identity issues. For staff women, the concerns, the primary issues tend to fall into career development, career laddering, salary equity, managing career and home concerns. For faculty women, the issues become a little more difficult, in that we're dealing with concerns of salary equity as a major issue, but also a more difficult issue of fairly traditional discrimination relative to who's got the power. And on this campus, faculty women are not in powerful positions in almost any realm of the system. For women who are wives of faculty, staff, and students, in talking with those groups, those women are interested in ways in which they can be more involved within the community that their mates are employed. They're interested in talking about ways that they can re-enter a job market if they've been the job field if they've been home for a number of years with small children. They're interested in ways to enhance their own intellectual and social lives if they choose to stay home and not work. We've had some good discussions with women in UWA about some programs that we'll be coordinating on in the coming year. Now, issues, again, as I said, most issues impact women regardless of where they are. Those health and educational, social and political issues are really the main emphasis of the Women's Center. Because we are on a university campus and because the largest number of women are students, the focus, I think, will naturally be on women students. That is, that's where the greatest amount of energy is. We've had tremendous enthusiasm from the students and suggestions for activities and projects that they'd like to see happen. Some of the kinds of activities that we have planned for the coming year and are looking at, we'll be instituting a regular series of brown bag lunches, topical kinds of lunches, a lecture series with more formal invited guest speakers to deal with a variety of issues concerning women, a series of workshops on, again, a variety of issues. We're doing some workshops in the dorms right now on rape prevention and sexual assault awareness. We'll be doing a workshop in the spring, a series of workshops in the spring on career options for women. We'll be doing a major workshop in February on student leadership for men and women, but specifically geared towards women, bringing women, encouraging more women to acknowledge their own leadership and hopefully providing them with a forum which will teach them skills to be more effective leaders. Another project that the students are working on right now is a radio program on KSUA. We have a two-hour block of time available on Sunday afternoons, and through the Women's Center, some students are going to be working, and we're providing some assistance, technical assistance, some financial assistance, and just resource assistance in putting together a format for a radio show to include music and talk and dialogue. And
as director, do you have a specific goal that you would really like to see accomplished this first year? You've got a number of projects going, but is there something more than I guess creating an awareness of the center that you would hope?
I guess the goal for me of a women's center is twofold. The primary goal is to be able to provide support, information, and education to women about themselves as women, to be a nurturing and influential factor in helping women to gain more self-confidence and self-assurance about themselves as potential leaders and influence makers in the world. The secondary aim, and it's not a far second, is to impact the university system, which is a traditionally male created and dominated system, to create through a variety of forums an awareness on the part of the system itself and the males that run the system that it's not enough for women to gain self-confidence and gain the skills necessary to influence the world, but the institutions themselves must change to accept a feminist perspective. Uh, when I talk about asking institutions to accept a feminist perspective, I'm often charged as being too radical. So I'd like to add just a little clarifying note to that. As a feminist myself, and I'm one of the people who does not consider feminist to be a dirty word these days, I've spent the last 15 years of my professional life involved with women's groups, leading various seminars and workshops in trying to teach women how to become female men, in effect. We have assertiveness training workshops, and we have dress for success workshops, and we have a variety of activities that have gone on over the last 15 years training women how to change themselves as women to be accepted into traditionally male systems. And I think the time has come for women to not hide the fact that they are women, but to get in touch with themselves as women and to begin asking the institutions in our society to accept us as we are. And I say that as to clarify the last goal, that I really want to see the Women's Center be a catalyst in trying to make those kinds of critical, fundamental changes in the institutions in our society.
Made a major effort this past year in the development of an honors program, which would be an attempt on our part to maintain our philosophy as a land-grant institution, relatively open admissions, but to provide within our structure of courses and classes and faculty some very specialized challenge programs for some very top-talented students. So that's an attempt that we've made to attract a particularly strong group and provide them with a really hard, invigorating, and intellectually challenging education. That program will be in its formative stages this year, and we'll be recruiting students for admission into that program. Admissions will actually start a year from this fall, so we're fairly excited about that. We have a number of internal problems relative to research associates, concurrent rank, tenure, non-tenure track professionals, in terms of trying to find a more equitable system in dealing with promotion and a variety of things for our employees who come from many disparate backgrounds. I think over the course of this next year, we're going to have to concentrate a lot more on refining our planning processes. One of our major difficulties at the present time is good long-range planning as it would pertain not only to academic programs, but also facilities. The campus is broken up into many small quadrants, and we've got to find a way of trying to bring it all together. So there'll be further concentration on the entire planning processes this next year. We're envisioning that within a few years we'll be perhaps one of the major schools in the country with student, faculty, and staff access to computers. We're seeing much modernization in that area, and I think this next year we'll be trying to finalize some preliminary planning that went on last year and putting together a major request for this campus. We have some requests on a statewide basis that we received this year that'll spurt our efforts in the academic computing area, but we think we're going to need much more, and we want to assure that we have a distributed but integrated system that will assist all users here in the university community. We envision trying to further strengthen many of our programs, both in the humanities, fine arts, and the sciences, through a visiting professorship program, where we will be inviting to the campus for short periods of time some of the very top talent, both in the country and internationally, to offer not only regular courses but a series of seminars, lectures, etc., both to students, faculty, and also the community at large. We're continuing to try to expand our special events program in terms of bringing other types of lecture talent to the campus on a regular basis. So we think we'll see more activity in that particular area. I'm trying to spur the arts interests in Fairbanks. We've taken some major steps toward trying to better support our theater program. We hope within the next few years to bring that up to a full professional program, which it is not at the present time. We have currently a good, strong music program. I think we'll see further strengthening probably in the academic and research capability of most of our programs on campus.
Is there anything you want to add?